Jawbone. Written by Mark McNeese. Produced and narrated by Wondervox AI. Copyright. Mademark Publishing. His name is Richard, but everybody's called him Jawbone since the accident. It was long ago, 33 years this coming December. He remembers it only in flashes of black and instants of pain, twitches and recoils at loud sounds and sudden movement. He was driving home from Michigan, just past the Indiana border, where you could go to a bar at 18 and be served. All the Indiana kids did it, or at least all the ones Richard knew. The reasoning went that if you could shoot a man dead for your country in a rice paddy halfway around the world, you should be able to order a beer in your own hometown. The changes would come later with the federal government threatening to withhold highway funds, forcing the morality of the few on the many. But in those days the states had rights, and his said he couldn't order a bourbon and coke while Michigan said he could. So on a cold winter night when the air was frigid, and the first warm place he thought of was Roscoe's Bar in Union, he drove there with every intention of making it home as whole as he'd left. That was not the case. A pickup truck coming in the opposite direction in a snowstorm saw to that. He doesn't remember the impact, except in his cells and his misshapen face. He doesn't remember the other driver, an old local man who lived a half mile from the accident site and who made it through the crash without a scratch. He had not been wearing his seatbelt, expecting not to need one. All he really remembers is the shock on people's faces when they saw him in the hospital, the nurses, the doctor, his parents. To a one, their mouths dropped open and tears filled their eyes. Could a boy who looks like this live? It's like going through life without a nose, or with your ears missing. That's how surprising it was. And then the pretense, the obvious conflict on their faces, as they told him they loved him, while they tried mightily not to look away. He could see them questioning the truth of their own assumptions. He's my son, but he scares me. He's my child, but he makes me want to vomit. Jawbone. As appropriate a nickname as ever there was. And now, all these years later, he sits alone in a house his father left when he died, then his mother, then the cat that outlived them both. The same house in which he failed to recover. The house children kept their distance from, cautioned by their parents to steer clear. Oh, not because the nice man who lived there had half a face, they would never be so blunt, but because the lawn was raggedy and snakes might curl up there, or because they weren't sure anyone was still alive behind the filthy windows. Anything but the truth. He had been frightening them for decades and no amount of reconstructive surgery would change that. Jawbone has had 17 surgeries. They have not succeeded in doing much but moving his features around, sliding his nose to the right a few centimeters, then back to the left when they repaired his eye. It was as if he'd been a canvas on which ambitious doctors took turns practicing their craft and their command of perspective. Nor, to his detriment, did their styles agree. The master surgeon in Indianapolis who'd promised him he would look normal again, the man whose ego was greater than any disfigured child's pain, gave up when he failed to deliver. He washed his hands of Richard's trauma and headed to Guatemala to repair hair lips for free and get himself profiled in Time magazine. The doctor after that, and the one after that, made efforts but no promises, and in the end, all they did just made it worse. The damage had been too great from the moment of impact, long ago on that snowy road. Christ, the lower half of the boy's face had been taken off in a single slice, so elegant, it defied probability. There was only so much modern medicine could do. At some point, you have to move on. He found out how quickly people move on. His best friend from high school, Frankie Carlson, thin as a stick and so pockmarked by vicious acne, he didn't need a traffic accident to make his life more difficult, stopped visiting within weeks. Jawbone remembered the last time they spoke. Frankie was sitting in the visitor's chair, staring blindly at a television set mounted on the... He hadn't said much in the 20 minutes he'd been there. He hadn't looked at Richard, and while Richard was already used to people talking to him without looking at him, the silence from Frankie was particularly meaningful. "Some of the guys from school want to throw you a party," Frankie said, leaning forward in the chair with his elbows on his knees. The guys were friends they shared from high school, which they'd both graduated the previous June. "When you get out, you know, when you're better." Frankie did not expect a reply. Richard had been unable to speak since losing the lower half of his jaw and would not be able to say anything intelligible for months to come, after the first surgeries and intense speech therapy. "I think it's a good idea," Frankie said. His foot began to tap rapidly. "But I told him, I said it's gonna be a while. Like, a long while, so, yeah, it'll be great, really, but, like, don't make any plans yet, that's what I told him. Frankie did not state the obvious, that none of the guys had come to see Richard and never would. Word had spread that the young man who had the head on was lucky to have, well, his head on, and half of that was missing. You know, Richie, Frankie said, the only person who called him that, each having used a diminutive of the other's name since third grade. I gotta take a little break. Maybe a couple weeks. I got this mechanics class starting up. I need to be able to support myself now. College is for smart people. People like you. And he caught himself short, finally glancing up at his friend, realizing the absurdity of what he'd just said. College was for just about anybody but people like Jawbone. You still be here in a couple weeks? The question was ridiculous, and they both knew it. Richard would be here or in some other therapeutic facility for a long time. Richard laughed at the thought. The sound of it, coming only from his throat, ragged and filled with phlegm, startled Frankie, who thought his friend was choking. You okay, dude? Frankie said, getting up and stepping to the bedside. Should I call a nurse? Having acted on reflex, Frankie was suddenly standing over Richard, looking directly into his face as it was now. There were bandages, but not ones that hid him entirely as one might hope with such catastrophic damage. The accident had made a clean cut, a harsh, brutal, but precise slice directly below Richard's front teeth, so fast and smooth that there wasn't any need to bury him in gauze. Frankie felt his eyes sting. He wasn't the toughest kid, but he'd been through his share of difficulties, and crying wasn't natural for him. He took one good look at Richard and turned toward the window. It had begun to snow again. It seemed that winter the snow would never stop. I gotta go, bud, he said. You get some sleep or whatever, and I'll see you soon. He reached out and patted Richard's hand, then walked out of the hospital room for the last time. Maybe Frankie knew something the rest of them didn't. The hopelessness of the situation, the inevitability of the life that lay ahead for someone in Richard's position. And he cut his losses that winter day. Unlike Jawbone's parents, and his grandmother who drove all the way from Des Moines to spend the following spring with him, as if a grandmother's love could make up for a life of stares and ridicule, Frankie knew what was coming and made his escape early. The people closest to Richard had no choice but to believe things would get better, that after this surgery or the next, he would resemble closely enough a normal young man. He could venture out, get a job, live a regular life. It's like when someone you love is dying and you know it, and everybody else knows it. But no one says a word. They just keep cheering at every positive test result and every hint of remission. But inside they know, and eventually the silence kills the comfort they might have offered had they just come out and said it. You're dying. Let's make the most of these last months. Let's talk about things that matter to us. And then the person dies, and they regret the lost opportunity. It was worse for Jawbone because he was not going to die anytime soon. So they pumped themselves so full of hope that when reality hit them as hard as that truck had hit Richard, there was nothing left to say. They had been proved wrong, made fools of. So they resigned themselves to living with a freak in their midst, and they did their best to act like nothing was wrong. But not Frankie. No. He was too honest in his adolescent angst. He knew his buddy Richard, soon to be Jawbone, would look like that forever, and he did not have the strength to stick around. Eventually no one did, and Jawbone swiftly withdrew into his house with his parents and their cat and his books and his hatred of reflections. He'd been a happy kid until the accident. He was an only child, given all the attention his parents had to give. They were a trio, doing most things together. His father, Harold Crump, worked at the post office, where he'd been promoted over the years from walking a route to managing the main office. Hal, as everyone called him, was a tall man, and large, who never quite grasped his size. It was as if his body had outgrown his perception of himself, as if he was stuck in a growth spurt from puberty, and he had never become fully coordinated. His large hands still fumbled with objects smaller than them, and he still sometimes misjudged his height, hitting his head on a low doorway or the roof of an automobile. Hal was affable, something everyone liked about him. His face was round to match the rest of him, soft and fleshy, and his easy smile was a contrast to the sadness in his wet brown eyes. Where the sadness came from was anyone's guess. Hal was not a man given to reflection or reminiscence, so anything that might have happened in his childhood to give him that hint of sorrow was lost forever in the privacy of his memories. Karen Crump worked as a bookkeeper for the town's only hardware store. Being the only hardware store made being the oldest moot, but that did not stop the owner from advertising himself that way. Clarkville's oldest hardware store, estimated 1929. There had never been another one, but Jack Cornwell thought the claim had served his father well and would serve his sons well too. After all, it was a family business, and it was nice to think you'd outlasted the competition even when there wasn't any. Karen was a small woman with prematurely colored hair, dark blonde that would not have shown gray easily, but she took no chances. Her hands were tiny but facile, and her fingers had known the buttons of a calculator so long she hadn't had to look at what she was adding and subtracting for years. She'd started working for Cornwell Hardware back when Jack Cornwell's father was still alive, old but determined to stand at the cash register a few hours a day and say hello to the customers he'd known since many of them were children. In fact, the day her son had his face cut in half just happened to coincide with her 20th anniversary at the store. She and Jack Cornwell, his two dull sons and their duller wives, had all gone out for dinner to honor her long service. Hal had not joined them, being uncomfortable in social situations and wanting Karen to enjoy the spotlight without her husband there to inhibit her in any way. As fate or God in one of his more perverse moments would have it, Karen arrived home from her celebration shortly before the hospital called to ask them if they had a son named Richard, and if so, would they please come to Memorial Hospital immediately? A life, in retrospect, is full of such coincidences. So many that it's easy to think there is an order to it, a plan, when in fact it's just a collision. The hundreds of events in our lives circle round like asteroids through the space of other lives, inevitably crashing into each other from time to time. A father dies the same day as his sister's cat. A car slams into a truck the very night the driver's mother is enjoying a toast to her 20 years of service. Time is long enough, and space wide enough, that such occurrences seem normal. But knowing it wasn't deliberate, knowing it was a fluke, did not make its taste less bitter, nor did it take the guilt away. Karen ever after insisted that had she not gone out for food and drink that night, had she gone straight home, it would have made a difference. It would have altered the time-space continuum just enough to avoid the crash. Her son's car would have turned sooner, or the truck would have veered out of the way, and their futures would have been completely different. No rational thinking could support this, but rational thinking has no place in a nightmare. Richard was only in the hospital for 6 weeks, a remarkably short time given his injuries. He was facing many surgeries, but the doctors determined there was no need for him to take up residence on a ward. The biggest concern was infection, but given proper instruction and training for him and his mother, there was no reason to think he couldn't recuperate in the comfort and familiarity of his own home. The day Richard left the hospital, his parents made the single biggest mistake of their lives. They arranged a celebration. They could not have anticipated no one showing up. They assumed Richard's friends would rally to his side once he was home. Karen festooned the front entrance and living room with balloons. She stayed up all night making a special recipe Black Forest cake, Richard's favorite. She'd called a dozen of his friends and received assurances they would be there. Everything seemed set for something to finally lift their son's spirits, if only for a day. They said nothing to Richard, the second biggest mistake of their lives. It was to be a surprise. They planned for him to know nothing until they opened the front door, and he saw the balloons and everyone standing there, some on one side, some on the other. A cheerful phalanx to usher him into his difficult world of recovery with shouts of, "Welcome home!" and, "We love you, Richard!" Karen should have known things were not going as planned when first one friend then another called that morning to say something had come up. A sick dog, an emergency at work. Of the 10 people she'd invited, 3 phoned her with last-minute regrets, and 2 others had their mother's call. She had to give them credit for that, considering the others just never showed up. It wasn't that they didn't care about Richard, or that they were not truly friends, but word had spread for weeks that he was hard to look at. Frankie had talked, the nurses had talked, the other patients had talked, and without having seen him for themselves, every single person who had once been Richard's friend, who'd gone with him to that very bar and spent time in their backyard in the summers, turned away. So it was on that homecoming day that Richard Crump discovered just how alone he was. They wheeled him out of the hospital in a wheelchair with a plant in his lap the nurses had given him. He waved at them and at the doctor who'd signed his discharge papers. His father got him into the car, and as they drove home, Karen felt a dread that had settled into her stomach at daybreak and not moved. a brick that just got fatter and heavier as they turned down one street, then another. She knew there was no one waiting for them. She'd hoped and even prayed someone would come, that a group of them had decided to surprise her as well, this hard-working, long-suffering mother, that it was a plot, but a good one, a way of showing her and Hal they had not been forgotten. She'd left the back door open and told them to gather out of sight in the living room. Surely a few would be there. But in that stone-heavy, ice-cold pit in her stomach, she knew better. And now, as they made the last right turn onto their street, her guilt, already gestating, found itself accompanied by recrimination. How could you be so stupid, Karen? How could you not know this would happen when not one of them offered to help? You don't really know any of them except Frankie, and he at least had the guts to say no. The rest had simply abandoned Richard. She had not yet decided if it qualified as betrayal, but it was certainly cruel. She wanted the car to slow down. She did not want to reach the house, ever, and as they approached the driveway, then turned into it, she began to shiver. There were balloons inside the front door, more in the living room. There was a cake on the table with "Welcome Home, Richard," written in yellow frosting. There were presents she and Hal had spent the past week shopping for and wrapping. And there was silence. Not one single voice to startle him from behind a door, just the silence of a house that might as well have been a tomb. Suddenly she couldn't breathe. "Wha matta?" she heard from the back seat. Richard was speaking now, but they were half words, short bursts that did not qualify as sentences, trading structure for brevity. "Nothing's the matter, sweetie," she lied. What was she supposed to do? Tell him now, as they came to a stop in the driveway, that she was about to make a fool of him? That something terrible, lonely, and so dense no light could escape it was about to be revealed? "Nothing," she muttered again, and decided he would never know that anyone else was supposed to be there. Richard Crump officially became Jawbone the first time he went out in public. A child called him that, not meaning any harm. The girl was just observant. He had gone to the pharmacy with his mother. He needed a refill on his pain medication. He always needed refills on his pain medication. And this time he said he wanted to go. It had been 6 months since anyone but his parents and the hospital staff had seen him. Others had glimpsed him, of course. You can't go in and out of hospitals without people noticing, but not up close. Not near enough to identify him or engage in small talk. For the rest of the world, the ones who had not shown up to celebrate his homecoming, he was a young man in a wheelchair coming quickly in and out of hospital entrances, always in a hooded sweatshirt, the hood pulled over his head. Already he had been operated on 3 times, once to graft skin from his back onto what was left of his lower jaw, once to craft that skin into something resembling a face, and once for the hell of it, or so it seemed to him. The 3rd time they hadn't really done much. It was an adjustment, a tune-up, in preparation for the much more difficult work that lay ahead with wiring and fusing and starting all over again from scratch. So that fine June Thursday he told his mother he wanted to go with her, to get out of the house. She relented, as mothers usually do, though she had a bad feeling about it. They had just finished watching one of the early morning news shows. That was how they spent every morning, keeping up on what had quickly become the outside world. Grandma Ellen had gone back to Des Moines 3 weeks earlier. She could only stay so long, having a home and a life of her own. Karen had taken an indefinite leave of absence from the hardware store to stay with her son. She suspected she would never go back, and at some point in the coming months, she would have to tell the brothers Cornwell, though she figured they already knew it. The connection between her anniversary celebration at the restaurant and her son's accident, while it existed only in her mind, was something she could not shake off. It made returning to work there too much like returning to the scene of a crime only she knew had been committed. The dread settled into her stomach as she backed the car out of the driveway, turning and churning somewhere between her navel and her groin. She'd felt it before. Plenty of times in her lifetime, everyone does. The knot, the fear, and the hot flushing. The sweat on the upper lip in a cool room. It sat there inside her. She tried to ignore it as they drove to the drugstore, and every inch of the way she knew this had been a bad idea. She should have had the medication delivered, or asked Hal to pick it up, anything but taken her disfigured son to a large, busy, cold, vast, open, uncaring public drugstore. Few people truly ask for trouble, but that's what she knew they were doing. Maybe we really do create the situations we live in. Maybe we ask for it. Whatever it is, trouble even. And after it was over, Karen wondered if her son had known all along that something would change, that he would be seen, and would see himself differently, once he was out of the safety of the hospital or his home, where everyone controlled their reactions to him, and were either professional, or loving, or steadfastly neutral. This had to happen. He would not be dying anytime soon. He could not stay hidden forever. It was such an innocent thing. He had the sweatshirt on, the hood pulled over his half face, and he was walking with his mother down the toiletries aisle. A woman with three children was reading labels on the backs of shampoo bottles, not paying much attention to her kids as they roughhoused in the aisle, two boys and a girl, all under 10. One of the boys chased the girl and she ran up the aisle, her sneakers squeaking on the tiles. She was looking behind her to see how close her brother was, and she ran into Richard, straight into his legs. His mother turned around. The girl's mother turned around, the movement having caught her attention. The brothers ran up to their sister and stopped. The girl looked up into Richard's face and screamed, at the top of her lungs, as if the devil had slid his tongue out and licked her cheek. She turned and ran for her mother, shouting, "Jawbone! Jawbone!" How the little girl knew about jawbones or ankle bones or any other kinds of bones was beside the point and not especially mysterious, but her shouting the word, preceded by her piercing little girl scream, brought them all running. The security guard, the pharmacist, the clerk filling a shelf with God knows what, and the other people who'd been shopping just as this terrible thing happened in their presence. A rape? A heart attack? Someone with a gun? Or a knife they'd plunged into a loved one? Normally people freeze or run the other way when they think something violent has happened, and might suck them in, but not this time. Maybe it was the scream of a child, that must have been it. People reflexively feel a need to protect the little ones. Only his mother felt the need to protect Richard. Karen took him by the arm and led him quickly to the exit. The damage had been done. The others had caught a glimpse of her son, and the little girl had given him a new name, a name other children would call him, neighbor children, and visiting relatives' children and teenagers, and the friends of teenagers, until, at some point, he became Jawbone to everyone outside his family. The crazy old man with half a head who lived in the house where his parents had died, or more likely, where he'd poisoned them and stuffed their bodies with cotton, kept them in the basement so he could go on talking to them every day. The one some parents remembered, but most did not, as neighborhoods change and people come and go. The one stories were told about, all of them, as is people's wont, horrible or frightening. Jawbone never held a job. His was not the sort of disability agencies help to overcome by finding him employment. It's one thing to work in a wheelchair or with a seeing-eye dog by your side. It's quite another to work with the lower part of your face missing. And back then, the computer age was in its infancy. There was no such thing as a telecommuter, no website to design from a bedroom. You either went to work, or you didn't work. And for Richard, the only choice was to stay isolated. He collected disability and still does. But the humiliation of it became part of him. Part of his identity as the freak behind the curtains. His parents loved him desperately, though Karen never stopped blaming herself, and Hal never stopped mourning what could have been. Grandchildren and barbecues and family portraits. Oh no, no portraits. The last extant picture of their son showed him at his high school graduation, smiling with his long dark hair and his toothy grin, cap set crooked on his head, the tassel dangling. But it was not how they would always remember him. Such sentiments are for those who have died. Richard lived on, and on and on. Hal was the first to go, dead in an instant from a stroke that exploded in his brain. He'd been at work giving some instruction to a new employee, and in the middle of a sentence his eyes had popped open wide as could be. He'd grunted once, and fallen face forward onto the counter. Snap. Over and done with. No warning, no apology. He was 52 years old. Karen held on for another 10 years, taking care of her son whose aloneness had long since become suffocating and complete. Her guilt those last years was equaled by her growing hatred, something that only made the guilt worse. She hated going home. She hated the smell she imagined emanated from her son's bedroom, though it was not a smell anyone else would detect. The smell of awful sameness, lost possibility, and unspoken accusation. Finally, she too decided it was time to die. Or God decided it for her, taking mercy on a woman who'd lost her son 20 years before and her husband 10. It was too much, really. So much that her sadness finally reached heaven. She knew by then that very few prayers made it there, So far away was it and so crowded with petitions. Hers had been simple. Let me die. Just let me die. She'd stopped worrying about her son's future. She'd even begun to think of him as cruel, with his stubborn stuckness, his refusal to live anything resembling a life, his perpetual silence. And every time she thought this, she would feel guilty. And round it went in a circle until her only wish was to be gone, like her husband, to fall forward or backward, or simply never wake up. Some angel heard her prayer and took it straight to God. And in her 60th year, she developed colon cancer, something she didn't even know a woman could get. When the doctor told her she could live 6 months with treatment, she declined the offer and decided to make it 3. She lied to Jawbone, for even she had come to think of him as that, and told him there was nothing they could do. He knew she was lying. He knew she wanted out. And despite the cruelty she thought was in him, he let her go. He did not protest with his pad and pen. He'd stopped speaking altogether some years before. Instead, he wrote in his big, awkward script, "I understand. I love you. I will be okay." Jawbone did not go to his mother's funeral. He had her buried next to his father, out there in that sterile cemetery where the dead were identified by flat plaques on the ground. He preferred headstones. One of the things he missed in his extremely sheltered life was the sight of a graveyard with all those interesting stones to read. Short headstones, tall ones, grand ones, ones so old the writing had been eroded from rain and dust and sun until they looked like bars of soap left standing in a shower. His life, the one he lived, was long ago and had been so short there was nothing to regret. He was finally as alone as a human being could be, and he liked it. Unknown to anyone, for everything he did was unknown, he began to paint, ordering the supplies off the internet. His mother had given him a computer, and a small crack opened into his world. A perfect crack, from which he could see out and no one could see in. He painted landscapes, mostly. Scenes of vast space interrupted only by stars, of water and trees, of immense valleys, none of them inhabited by one single, solitary person. There were no faces in the worlds he painted. Jawbone did not expect to live forever, but he did not expect to die soon either. What he expected was to go on existing behind those filthy curtained windows, far back into the house where he could not possibly be seen, painting his dreams. It was nothing. And for a man who had once been a boy driving on the wrong night to meet a twist of fate so complete its after obliterated its before, it would have to do. The End. Written by Mark McNeese. Produced and narrated by Wondervox AI. Copyright, Mademark Publishing.